Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
All right, thank you very much for that, Bob. By the way, I enjoyed the last segment that the gang was talking about the Olympic Games, because I watched last night starting with just the Parade of Nations. So I missed some of the real stadium-sized artistry and the things they're able to project and do. I'll have to go back and watch that. But I think from what I've seen, some of the images, it was pretty awesome. And then, of course, the athlete by athlete. And we were all, I think, really struck if you were there. You know, I've heard from people. I've talked to a friend today, and he goes, oh, I never watched the opening. That's so boring. It's too long. And you can't talk people into appreciating the ceremony if you don't like the ceremony. But when the refugees came in, that was a really touching moment. And I think this is the first time that they let the refugees compete under the Olympic flag without actually being able to represent a country. Now, you just mentioned that Syrian swimmer in the 100-meter butterfly won her heat but didn't have a good enough time, and so she doesn't advance.
But still, that's not nothing.
Well, when I get to be king, if you win your heat, maybe you would have gone faster if you'd known there was somebody ahead of you. I know they know the rules, but come on, if you win your heat, plus if you're one of these sad refugees, let's give them a break. let's advance the heat winners to the next round. When I get to be king of the Olympics,
just
man.
Just make a bigger pool. That's all you need, to make the pool bigger.
Exactly. There's ways around this. Come on, let's think out of the box.
Not longer, wider. Right?
It's exactly.
Olympic size,
right.
So that refers to length. But width
still 100 meters, but instead of 8 lanes, how about 13,
yes.
14, whatever it takes?
I think it's fine. That's what I like about the Olympics, too. I remember once, this is in the 80s or something, a marathoner just barely being able to do it and just having to like stumble his or her way. I don't remember if it was a man or a woman, but still making it, you know? That was awesome. Eddie the Eagle.
One of the 400-meter runners, I think, broke his leg or his foot while he was running, or pulled his hamstring so badly and he was crying, and his dad came out of the stands and held his son as they limped across the finish line. It's those moments that resonate, I think, with a lot of us, too. Okay, so let's do this. I want to backtrack for just a minute. You remember, I'm going to play for you a 20-second soundbite here. You remember when Khizr Khan, we all now know that name, the guy that held up the pocket constitution at the Democratic National Convention, said,
have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy. In this document, look for the words liberty and equal protection of law.
Now, guess what happened after he did that? Within 48 hours, that pocket constitution was in the top 10 best-selling books on Amazon. It cost, at that time, 99 cents. Dan Sheridan is a historian. He's an educator, and he's also a spokesperson for the group whose pocket constitution moved up on the list. It's a Center for National Constitutional Studies. And I wanted to touch bases with him for just a minute and see how things are going. Hey, Dan, it's John, and you're on WGN. How are you?
It's good to be with you, John. I'm doing good. Thank you for having me.
The name of your organization is what again?
It's the National Center for Constitutional Studies.
And so I guess that's kind of self-explanatory. I understand that you're a nonpartisan group, and you want people to better understand the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We're interested, primarily we started to educate people on the founding documents, especially the U.S. Constitution. But like you said, it's primarily about the education of the principles behind the U.S. Constitution and Declaration of Independence. Yes, sir.
That's a great moment in American politics all of the sudden. Were you watching when Mr. Khan held up that pocket constitution?
Yeah, I was watching live. It was quite the sight to see.
And your book then, that is the one that your company produces, what happened to sales after that?
Well, for between Saturday morning and Monday night afterwards, we had orders for a total of 45,000 pocket constitutions. And I don't think in our history we've seen that many orders. We've sold 45,000 in a week before, but this was in 3 days. But what was unique about it is how many individual orders are people who are just ordering two or three at a time. A lot of people, when they order them, they'll buy a bulk, like a bulk of 100 or something like that. But this was one of those times where we had a lot of individuals ordering, you know, one, two, or three copies.
The irony, as I understand it, is that the one he held up and waved and people then pushed you to the top of the Amazon list wasn't your pocket constitution. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And we still don't know whose it was. When he held it up, I you know, when he actually held it up, I didn't care whose it was. I was just kind of excited to see the document part of either convention. And so I don't know whose it was, but it was just great to see him referencing that document, and in the context in which he referenced it was just fantastic.
How have sales been since then?
They've been going very well. We didn't sell, you know, that many in 3 days since then, but it's been going really steady. Just so you know, we've given out over 16 million of them since we started this project in 2004. And we're just in the process of printing another 4 million right now. And I think I mentioned to you before that we're looking to get out 100 million copies in the next 12 months.
Why? What's that all about? You want one for every three people in this country?
Yeah, we'd like to get one into every American's hands. But, yeah, our goal over the next year is we're really making a push to try to get the message of the founding fathers into the hands of as many Americans as possible. We picked 100 million, and so we have a program going right now where we're trying to get the copies out, 100 million copies in the next year.
I'll tell you in just a minute how to get a copy of his. Is it still a buck?
Well, it depends. It's less than a buck. When you buy them, you can get them a lot less than that. It's like 40 cents for 100. So 100 copies, it's 40 cents per pocket constitution.
Who doesn't have $40 for liberty, justice, and the American way?
Well, we're getting a lot of orders. People are actually sending us pictures when they get their boxes in the mail, and somebody is actually filming going around as he's handing them out to people. So it's fun seeing people excited about sharing with their neighbors and friends the great heritage that our country has.
My wife wants to have a party the night of the election. It's either going to be a celebration party or a mass mourning, but either way, she thought that the Constitution would be a great party favor for our event. And in fact, I'm in the business of talking to dead presidents. You probably don't know this, but I interview Teddy Roosevelt on stage next Saturday. A week from today, we'll just be getting off the stage. And around the time of the election itself, I'll be on stage with Thomas Jefferson. We should hand everybody one of your pocket constitutions that comes to our event.
I would be happy to get them to you if you'd like.
What is the value of this? You know, Jefferson will tell us that the Constitution should be more pliable than we make it, that we should be amending it and changing it more often.
Well, I you know, he also said that he didn't think that one generation should bind the next generation to their laws, but I think Jefferson's point would be that one thing we shouldn't do is change the Constitution by altering it. It should be changed through the process that's put in place. It's by amendment. And, you know, they had come from a background where it was a government of men and not of laws. And laws were changed by the whims of men. And the reason why they wrote the Constitution was to ensure that we go through a process of argument and debate over what's wise and proper. And I think that's really the best way to handle any law. So if somebody thinks that the Constitution is out of date in some part of it, the way to change it is through the process that the Constitution lays out, and it's through amendment, which requires discussion, debate, and wisdom. So that's the best way to change it.
And maybe a little civility, too, which seems to be lost these days. And that's why I think this conversation you and I are having is not partisan. And you're not, right?
No.
You're not.
No, absolutely not.
I think we should all just know our roots a little bit better. And it's been a struggle for me. The first time I met Thomas Jefferson, and I'll pause while you think about that. I was going, are you the guy that did the Constitution or the other one, the Declaration? And, you know, that's just my own ignorance that I've tried to patch up since then. How do people get copies of the book then that you guys have, which is, again, the Constitution and the Declaration in one little pamphlet? How do I get that?
What you do is you go to freedomfactor.org. It's freedomfactor.org. And that's our website that has the specials we're running on the Pocket Constitution. That's part of our effort to get the 100 million out. And you talk about nonpartisan. If you look on that page, you can watch a little video that I wrote and our organization produced on why we need the Constitution and how, as you just pointed out, it's a document that should bring us together. It's nonpartisan, and it should unite us. It's a message that should unite us.
Freedomfactor.org, freedomfactor.org. Okay, Dan Sheridan, let's you and I bump into each other once in a while. In fact, maybe we ought to get you some tickets and come see Thomas Jefferson when he visits with us in the fall.
Well, let's do that. I'd be happy to. And also, one more thing, if I may, we also do Constitution seminars. So if they want to have a seminar, they can contact us, and we'd be happy to come out and put one on.
Freedomfactor.org. Okay, Dan Sheridan, nice to talk to you, sir. Good luck.
You too. You have a good day.
They got a ways to go, but why not? 100 million they want to get out there. I'm on board. That should be nice little program features. Somebody's scratching their head now on the staff listening to me go, oh, yeah, we'll do that. I'm getting my Lou Manfredini on. Hey, I know. We'll go ahead and do this tomorrow, and I'm not sure how it's going to happen. But we should have those, certainly for the November show. Teddy Roosevelt's on stage with me 1 week from today. Those tickets are virtually sold out. I believe we can seat 750. And I think we've sold 715, so I think you can still get a ticket. They told me not to promote it too much today. Your last chance will be to go to WGNradio.com/events, and you can order tickets online. There's a number to call there, too. We might have time in just a minute to talk to Lee Nelson, the Iowa Ambassadors of Music. You want to cry? You're going to feel so good about something? Listen to this next on WGN. A video went viral this week out of Iowa, of all places. Before the show today, I talked to the guy that made it happen. Oh, you need me to... And it was such a clean little introduction there, too. Okay, give me the high sign when we're ready. This is a conversation that I had before the show today, and it's with a guy named Lee Nelson from Iowa. And I love this little story, so let me play this little conversation for you.
This happened a couple of weeks ago. Here's how MSN tells it. An American soldier gave his life on a World War II battlefield. He got a hero's welcome more than 70 years later at the end of a Delta Airlines flight from Frankfurt, Germany to Atlanta on July 18th. The pilot informed the passengers that a U.S. Army private would be escorting the remains of a World War II soldier off the plane before everyone could disembark. As the soldier's remains were transported, members of the Iowa Ambassadors of Music Choir, who happened to be on that flight, spontaneously sang a rendition of the Battle Hymn of the Republic in his honor. The moving performance of the choir singing Glory, Glory, Alleluia was captured on video by a fellow passenger. She posted it, and this week it's going viral. That video, in part, includes this. It's really touching. It's one of those scenes you might imagine, too. You've seen people on an airplane where they're taking the video, and it's kind of over the seat. It's tight quarters. It's never a great view. But it sure does capture the music there. And when you know the backstory, you just think, oh, my God, how sweet of these kids. The timing is perfect. The patriotism we could all use right now. Lee Nelson is the choir director of the Iowa Ambassadors of Music.
Hi, John. It's an honor to be on the radio with you.
Yeah, well, likewise, my friend. You must be very proud of those kids.
Yeah, you know, it's surreal. We never thought anything of it other than we need to honor the remains of this soldier, and then also the dressed, the uniformed soldier that was escorting
right.
the remains out.
Right.
Color
yeah.
guard.
Yeah.
And it was a special moment.
Well, and you're the director of these kids, is that correct?
Yeah. Yep. I'm the director of the choir. There's a choir and a band, an honor choir and an honor band. And so I was in charge of the 140 voice choir.
How many of the kids were on that flight?
Approximately about 70 of the students were on that flight.
So do I hear 70 kids singing then?
Yeah, and on two different sections of the plane. So we were on the front half and the back half, and a wall separating us. So one of the other choral advisors, choral chaperones, Mr. Luke Johnson, conducted the front half, and then I conducted the back half, and we just looked at each other and mirrored each other, and so we sang sort of invisibly and connected through the music together.
Well, you must have scrambled. I mean, take me through that. You didn't know until, my understanding is, the plane landed and the pilot made that announcement, what was about to happen. How did you coordinate that so quickly?
We were sitting in the exit row, and the flight attendant had mentioned to us as we were getting ready to land that the color guard would be meeting the plane to escort the remains off, and thought perhaps we could sing something in honor of the soldier. And so Battle Hymn of the Republic was something that we closed all of our concerts with over in Europe, and we decided to sing the Glory Hallelujah. So we scrambled to spread the word on both halves of the plane, and the kids were up for more than 24 hours. They had been flying since the day before, and they just rose to the occasion, and it was a very moving moment.
How thoughtful of that flight attendant.
Absolutely. It was really beautiful. We had tears in our eyes. The flight attendant had tears in her eyes. It was, surreal.
Dude, I got tears in my eyes.
Wow. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing when someone can capture a moment like that was done solely to show respect and honor and love for someone who gave the ultimate gift, the ultimate sacrifice, their life.
Do you know if the soldier who carried the remains off was clued in, and what was his reaction? Could anybody tell?
You know, we couldn't tell. He was leaving the plane at the time, and the color guard was coming up to meet. So he could hear it through the hallway, we figure, but we never got to see the uniformed soldier again.
What a touching salute, Lee.
It was meant to be, because we were on 350 students on this trip, and we had the one plane from Frankfurt to Atlanta with the most students on it.
Right.
So most of the other planes wouldn't have been able really to make this happen and to coordinate it. And as the choral conductor of it, I think it was just simply meant to be.
Yeah, what if it was the tuba players? Well, we can't exactly whip those out. What are we going to do?
Right. Well, what was pretty special was some of the band students were on the plane as well, and they joined in singing with us. There were even other passengers that were sort of singing along with us as well.
What are you hearing?
The response was unbelievable. I mean, this little snippet has sort of gone viral, and now I'm getting emails from all over from soldiers themselves, or from people whose family has been lost. And I think it hit at a really important time in our nation when we needed something like this sort of a story, as opposed to all of the other political stories that are kind of swarming around right now. This was just a moment of honor and patriotism and unity, which was really beautiful. And I'm glad music could be that vehicle.
So 24 hours without any sleep and really not rehearsed, pitch perfect. They stood in the aisle, they stood in their seats, and the kids sang that song. If you Google Iowa Ambassadors of Music Airplane, you will get that. And a picture we'll never see, and maybe we shouldn't, is the image of the face of the soldier who is carrying the remains of the World War II soldier off that Delta flight. So cheers to the kids in Iowa. There's a version of that, the Illinois Ambassadors of Music, I believe. I think it's in all 50 states, but that was Iowa. Well done, well done. The news coming up on WGN. So a week from today, Saturday, Bob, how about this? I walk onto stage, and then when the thunderous applause dies down,
okay,
you know, 30, 40 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, whatever. I don't know how long they're going to clap.
5 minutes.
When that dies down, I say, here's my friend Bob Kessler. You walk out with your harmonica, and then you do some sort of musical tribute to Teddy Roosevelt, right?
Yes.
And how long do you think that song's going to go?
If I do it all the way through with all the repeats, it's 2 minutes.
Well, that's not so bad.
I don't have to do all the repeats.
Yeah, I don't.
Because
I don't
the way marches work, I'm going to do the harmonica wizard march.
Right.
They have sections that repeat, and I don't have to do that. So,
well,
why don't I gauge the room and, you know.
Yeah, maybe it's up to you. You're the professional musician.
I did it at an open mic night the other night to test it out.
How did that go?
Thunderous applause. So factor in another 5 minutes.
Well, did you bring your harmonica with you today?
I have one somewhere, yeah.
Is there any chance that maybe after the, I don't know, 2 o'clock news or 2:30, you could sample a little of it for us?
Sure. Yeah. Yes, I can.
Well, okay, good. We'll do that. And I was thinking maybe you could actually, as people are filing in, be playing a little up there. But then maybe it's better if we just walk you out, Bob Kessler, and then you could maybe introduce why you're playing this particular song. It's a Sousa March, which was popular when Roosevelt was president. And in fact, there's a harmonica named after the 26th president, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. And then you play, huh?
That sounds spot on.
And then you feel the room, and then when you get done, you take a bow. I'll come out 4 or 5 minutes later after the applause dies down, and then we'll get rolling with our show. Sounds like a good plan, right?
Sounds like a great plan.
That's Bob
Kessler.
I like
this plan a lot.
In the WGN Radio Newsroom. I'm John Williams. I think there's 30 tickets left. We were at 715, and I think we can sell 750. Don't call me a liar if they don't have tickets, but if you go to WGNradio.com/events, there's the box office information there. 10 a.m. at the College of DuPage next Saturday. The most joyful president this country has ever produced will be on stage, and boy, will we have fun. I'll talk to him, and then you get to ask questions, too. It's at this segment that we always do The Mincing Rascals. The Mincing Rascals is a podcast that we produce at WGN on Fridays, and that's when we drop it. It's there at WGNplus.com. It's also on my Facebook page. I'm King John there. And you can subscribe to The Mincing Rascals. It's Eric Zorn, Steve Bertrand, and Kristen McQuarrie. McQuarrie and Zorn from the Chicago Tribune. And, of course, you hear Steve Bertrand on WGN Radio. So we recorded the one this Friday. We got into a lot of stuff. We spent a lot of time talking about whether or not giving $400 million to Iran was a ransom payment. $400 million to Iran, was that a ransom payment or not? You may care to comment on that now. We also then segued from that into sort of a Donald Trump's greatest hits. And this is the part where we go from the ransom conversation to the Trump tweets and comments. Listen to this on WGN.
Someone said, you know, only Donald Trump could say giving someone back their own money is paying a ransom.
Well, I'd like to see a deeper dive on exactly what we think we are paying them back for.
Fair enough. Let's go to the political scene then for a minute, because it is about that video that Donald Trump said over and over again. You can tell that the government of Iran has released this video to embarrass us. It wasn't the same video. The video he was looking at was of the hostages being released. There weren't any pallets of cash. In fact, I started to make a list of some of the most jaw-dropping things that Trump has said since he began running for office, and that one doesn't even make my top seven. I asked you guys to come up with your top three. This sounds kind of silly, but in a way, it's not, because he is saying these things almost always with a straight face, right? This week, what did he say? That the elections were rigged, or was that last week? He called Hillary Clinton the devil.
We're still dealing with the fallout from the Khan family, and he talked about how he had sacrificed, too. I think that,
right.
That was the Sunday interview, right? And so was the Purple Heart this week or last week?
This week,
I gave him the Purple Heart, and he said, gosh, I've always wanted one of these.
And
nobody wants
was
a Purple Heart.
And this was easier.
I don't think it's easy to be interviewed by George Stephanopoulos. Go on any of these shows, and you have to know what the right answer to the question is in real time right now. And if you're not a practiced politician, you haven't done this. So, for instance, if you guys were sitting there, and you know that every word you say is going to be microanalyzed, and I said, if your sister or daughter were being sexually harassed at work, what would she do, or what should happen?
Go get another job?
Quick, what's the answer to that? And you may just, you know, get defensive and say, well, my sister is strong and she would fight back. She wouldn't put up with that. She'd hit the door, Jack. Oh, wait, crap, that's the wrong answer. But that's the answer that Eric Trump gave this week. I'll bet he knows better. I think that's just showing somebody who's not very practiced.
Well, didn't Donald Trump also say that he thought that she would go get another job?
And what is the correct answer to that question?
That she would go to the authorities and she would fight it, to say that you're going to upend your career and go find another job because someone is assaulting you or abusing you, that makes you the victim. That's a terrible answer.
So what are your lists of the top three most offensive things that he has said?
I'll go first. Number three, in reverse order, religious tests for Muslims. Number two, I'd like to hear his wife say something. That's the Kaiser Khan comment. Number one, I wrote Ted Cruz's dad may have had a connection to the JFK assassination, but then I crossed that out and put, after the Orlando nightclub attack, he tweeted, appreciate the congrats for being right on radical terrorism. But then I crossed that out and put in the picture he tweeted of him eating a taco bowl from the Trump Tower after he'd said something unfortunate about Mexicans.
No, it was so Cinco de Mayo.
It was Cinco.
And so he was saying, I love the Hispanics. See, we have the greatest taco bowls at Trump Tower.
That's Kristen, what are yours?
I mean, that I just think is just like so, it just, you have to laugh or you'll cry. I'll figure out the laugh cry. Third, I'm stealing from Kristen Decker. She passed around a list, and she should jump in here too. But he tweeted out something about how Hillary Clinton, you know, couldn't please her husband, and made a reference to that's why, you know, he cheated on her. That's so ignorant. I can't even begin.
If she can't please her husband, how can she please the country?
Yes,
or
something
like
along
that.
Those lines.
Satisfied.
Right. And then during his announcement speech, when he literally it came out of his mouth, you know, Mexicans are sending over rapists. That's number two. Number one, the thing that the visual of him that keeps focusing on is when he mocked the disabled reporter from the New York Times. And that to me was just so egregious. And I did a little research on it and looked at this reporter. And in fact, the reporter does have a muscular disorder where his right arm is kind of curled up, almost like if you had bad arthritis and you were in your 90s or something. And that then they did know each other. And he had interviewed Trump numerous times, and Trump lied about that. And the way he mocked him was clearly, you know, he was making fun of his disability. And it just, I just that one is really painful for me.
How about you, Mr. Bertrand?
I think my number one is the Muslim ban. And in my mind are the ones I think that will, in the end, do him in. Anyone who looks at that Muslim ban shows that it conveys a fundamental misunderstanding of this country, not just what it stands for, but the laws of this country. I mean, I don't know how to say it any more clearly than that. The second one, which I think will cost him greatly, is the Purple Heart comment, because he was doing well, I think, among military men and women. And for him to take a Purple Heart from someone who was injured defending this country and insist that it was the original Purple Heart, when the man who gave it to him told him it was a copy 5 minutes earlier, A. B, to say, I've always wanted a Purple Heart, this way is easier. Well, it's like, someone gave him one. It's so much nicer than being shot. You know?
Tammy Duckworth.
Yes, I was just going to bring it up. Go
ahead. Best response by tweeting a picture of herself with the Purple Heart in a hospital bed saying, this is how you get a Purple Heart, nothing easy about it.
And then number three was just one that came this week. It's not really a big gaffe, but when he said again that he's not ready to endorse Paul Ryan.
Kristen, I saw a video of an ad that the Clinton campaign has mocking showing Donald Trump mocking the New York Times reporter. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was inappropriate too, because ultimately that's them perpetuating the mockery of the reporter. I think they should not do that. I understand the temptation, but there's enough low-hanging fruit. I wish they had, you know, this is the one with the kids. No, this is the one where they show Donald Trump acting palsied like that reporter does.
Yeah, but the kids are watching on TV.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. No, nah. Really? Because I've been saying for a few weeks that I don't want to see the Clintons go there. And I think that's kind of going there. If that's such a repulsive act that Trump did, then stop replaying it on my TV.
I mean, he did it at a rally. It's so out there. And this, I mean, are the Clintons going to go there? Absolutely. How do you not? And they did it in almost, I don't want to say a tasteful way, but, you know, that's the commercial that says kids are watching. This is what kids are watching. And
I think that's actually a narrative that's really ringing true, because I've had conversations with friends that are Muslim, and my friend's 4-year-old came home from a play date and said, Mom, somebody, you know, my friend told me on the playground that Donald Trump's going to send us away. And like, that's a conversation my friend had to have with her 4-year-old.
Kristen Decker, our producer of The Mincing Rascals. You heard Kristen McQuarrie there, the editorial writer and sometimes columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio, of course. Eric Zorn's one of The Mincing Rascals. He was not able to join us this week. I don't know if we missed one. Was there one out there that you go, holy cow, if you're going to do Donald Trump's greatest hits, you didn't do that one? What one was that? 312-981-7200. You can chime in on what you've heard. 312-981-7200. Also, before we get done, David Huddleston has passed away at the age of 85. You know him from a number of things, certainly Big Lebowski. And that gives us occasion to go back and play some fun clips from that. So that's all to come, including your calls. 312-981-7200. Trump's greatest hits. If we missed one, let me know right now. This is WGN. All right, let's pick up a couple of phone lines here real quick. I think I just tore up the piece of paper I had my names on. Joe, you go first. Hey, Joe, you're on WGN. What can I do for you?
Yeah, if I were Donald Trump, I'd simply put the question to Mr. Kahn. Well, since vetting doesn't work, it's not possible to vet people from who are escaping from a war zone, what would you do to keep terrorists out of the country? And that is the first duty of the president, to keep the terrorists out.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. Protecting us is the first duty of the president. That's not exactly my point, though, is it? I mean, it's amazing that he was able to say that. It's amazing that the next day he couldn't just walk it back, say, I shouldn't have inferred anything about the faith of the mother. She was grieving for her son. Why was it so hard for him to do that?
The problem is that Donald Trump is not a career politician. Any career politician would have jumped on that in a heartbeat. Donald Trump is like me. He's like everybody else out there. You put them up in front of the camera, and you concentrate on every little word that they say. You go back and try to nitpick
it. Well, that's the problem he had in real time. And, you know, that's kind of my point, though. So, I mean, that was my point to Steve Bertrand. I said, you know, if I was sitting on the couch and George Stephanopoulos said, what do you do about this situation? I know on the way home I would think of a better answer. But on the way home, if I realized that I questioned the faith of that woman as the reason for her silence, the next day I would have been back on some show and I would have said, I feel terrible about what I said. And then I would have patched it up. And so it's more than just his inability as a not career politician to handle that kind of question. He wouldn't do it. He knew but wouldn't do it. Right?
Yeah, but that's not his nature. That's not a big problem.
No, it's not.
Ask yourself why we make something so trivial as the on-air back and forth mean more than it does. Why do we do that? It's nonsense.
That's an interesting point, Joe. I appreciate your phone call. I'm going to go from you to Joanne, and then I'm going to regret having brought this up. Hi, Joanne. You're on WGN. What can we do for you?
Good afternoon, John. My point is going back to long before he became the designated candidate, Chris Matthews took him on one-to-one. And towards the tail end of that town hall meeting, he asked about pregnancy and if the woman's choice was to have an abortion, then that woman should be punished. And if you listen just before they end that town hall, he comes back and he reiterates that there is no punishment towards the men. And Chris Matthews can do anything but keep his mouth from dropping down.
I remember that
and
line.
I know he went after him. But they haven't, you know, for Hillary wanting to go after women's health, you've got to bring back in this issue. That one just blows my mind.
Thanks for the phone call. He did eventually.
You're welcome,
thanks, Joanne. And that was one where then later on Donald Trump said, okay, I'm not a practiced politician. I got that one wrong. We should not punish women who get abortions. But he sure did say that a couple of times in that Chris Matthews interview. But he did, as they say, walk that one back. But it took him a while to do that. But he did. So if you're keeping score at home, I think the last statement is the most pertinent one. And he doesn't think, if I understand correctly, that those people should be punished. The news is right around the corner. We'll do that at 2 o'clock. Remember the Mincing Rascals podcast. You can always hear in its entirety at WGN Radio. Let's see, what is it? It's at WGNplus.com. And it's also on my Facebook page. And I'm King John on Facebook. You can hear the Mincing Rascals in a half hour of uninterrupted glory right there. We last week visited with Amy Krauss Rosenthal. She is the author of many books. Her latest one is Textbook Amy Krauss Rosenthal. In fact, if you go to Textbook Amy K-R, as in Krauss Rosenthal, Textbook amykr.com. You'll find out about this amazing book she has embedded in the book, written into the book, because it's a paper product. Written into the book are numbers that you can text to. And when you do, the book, if you will, responds back to you. So it's sort of integrating the analog, the old real-world books that we've grown up with the digital world. It's very clever what she's done. It's the, I guess, first interactive paper book ever published. And now she's doing an event about that. It's, what is she calling it? She's calling it the Day of Beckoning Lovely. She's lyrical that way. And she's going to do this August 9th from 8.09 a.m. to 8.09 p.m. at the Bean in Grant Park, of course, or in Millennium Park. So she has an opening ceremony at 8.09 a.m. I have the whole itinerary. I won't read it all. I just want you to know that if you are an Amy Krauss Rosenthal fan, and we are on this show, or if you're looking for something fun to do on the 9th, that would be tomorrow, head on down to the Bean. And at the big picnic table, there will be this best-selling author, and she's going to be doing all sorts of activities, including a quick field trip over to Barbara's books, and then a reading, and then song, and then magic, or all sorts of odd activities. At one point, at 4:45 p.m., John Green, the author of many books you've heard of, we'll FaceTime chat with Amy. You can take a turn to say hi. You can take a screenshot. She'll text it to you. Details of that are on page 193 of the real book. So it's just a very fun, imaginative, clever day. And that's going to be at 8.09 to 8.09 p. And that'll be at the big picnic table tomorrow at the Bean. Good for you, Amy Krauss Rosenthal. The website is textbookamykr.com. The news is coming up on WGN. Thank you, Bob. Chaos Monkeys is a New York Times bestseller. I'm John Williams. Antonio Garcia Martinez is on the phone line. His book is subtitled Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley, Chaos Monkeys. And by the way, Antonio, welcome to the show. You're on WGN. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for having me on your show.
I want to turn to the dedication page. To all my enemies, I could not have done it without you. Okay.
Indeed.
That's pretty funny and maybe telling. First, tell us what a chaos monkey is. Why the title of the book? What are those things?
Yeah, so it's actually, believe it or not, it's a piece of software that Netflix created. And what it does is it actually goes to their data center and basically turns off or shuts down a random server. And then they test and see if they can still stream House of Cards to you, for example. So imagine a wild, crazy monkey literally running through a data center, just knocking over stuff. And metaphorically, what it means is that, you know, these days, Silicon Valley is the zoo where the chaos monkeys are kept. And what that means is, you know, somebody will come and say, look, we're not going to have taxis anymore. We're going to have this app called Uber, and everyone's going to be a taxi driver. Or, you know what, we're not going to have hotels anymore. Anyone with a spare bedroom can use this app called Airbnb and rent out their spare bedroom. And so Silicon Valley, in many ways, is like this crazy monkey that runs around and just pulls the plug on random industries and changes everything. And the question is, you know, do we as a society survive that chaos monkey necessarily?
Survive or benefit from it, right?
Right. I mean, yeah, it depends. Yeah, it depends whether, you know, you're the founder of Airbnb or not, right? That opinion. You know, I wrote part of the book, actually, in Barcelona. I'm a Spanish citizen. And in Barcelona is Airbnb's largest European market. And the real estate market there has been absolutely roiled by Airbnb, to the point that there's entire city blocks or buildings in Barcelona that are nothing but basically Airbnb rental units with no local residents whatsoever. Hmm. And so I think, yes, I mean, you're right. It's great as a user. But I think if you were a local resident in Barcelona, you might have a very different, you know, impression of Airbnb as a construct.
Do you agree with this, Antonio? That is, it's sort of like the coal miners who want the coal mines back. And the truth is, we're never going to have a vibrant coal industry the way we did, because that's evolution. AM radio is not what it once was, and I can't fight that either. And maybe taxi drivers just have to accept the fact that it's a non-judgmental thing. It just is. There will be an Uber. That's technology going forward.
Right. I think that's right. Most technologists would actually cite the inevitability of this transformation as a defense. I guess my response to that would be, you know, I used to go to a lot of these startup pitches. The incubator that funded my first company has a demo day in which all the companies it funds, you know, sort of present to the gathered VCs, and almost every company is basically putting either a blue-collar or a white-collar person out of a job, either through software or through robotics and automation. Like, literally every company is like a class of job, either disappearing or becoming lower wage and sort of less important. And so I think, yes, you're right. For Uber, it's great to use. I use it myself, right? I can hardly accuse anybody else of, you know, using Uber. But on the other hand, sort of in the macro aspect, I think we haven't really thought about what the impact of that means, I think, long term.
Oh, it's all happening so quickly. I get that. But this is funny coming from you, isn't it? I mean, there you were with an office just down the way at Facebook from What's-His-Face.
Yeah.
And when you left Facebook, you went to Twitter, right? I mean, you're kind of one of the founding fathers of this technology, are you not?
Well, No. I was but one player in a vast drama. But yes, I was definitely an insider. I'm not an outsider pointing in. I was an insider mocking in many ways myself and people like me. That's absolutely right. Yes, that's correct.
Talk to me about your time at Facebook. I mean, what were you? I know what you were doing there. You were actually, at least at one point, involved in aggregating information from our internet use for Facebook's advantage, right?
Yeah, my first job at Facebook was product manager for ads targeting. And what that means was I led the team that takes your data and basically used it to monetize Facebook. And so, for example, if you go and browse, you know, for shoes or whatever randomly on the internet, and then you see either that product or products like it inside your Facebook experience, then me and my team built the first version of that. That's what we built. We actually joined your Facebook experience to the entire outside world of data, including offline data. So even in-store things that you buy with your Safeway card or Target or whatever, that also gets joined to Facebook. Yeah.
So you're the guy. You're the guy that did that to me. Is that right?
You know, hate the game, not the player. But yes, I was the guy who happened to be. And by the way, a lot of this was, you know, pilfered or inspired by other technologies. I mean, Facebook was actually very late to the game and didn't pioneer almost any of it.
Well, because
they just did it better than those.
Understood. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg actually wasn't that interested in this. I'm amazed in your telling of the story at the meeting, for instance, where you all pitched this, that he wasn't either very involved on a sort of code writing level, like how does that experience work, or that he even saw the possibility. He was kind of meh about it, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. I mean, he's famously uninterested in advertising and revenue. I mean, the closest analogy I can cite, it's kind of like the CEO of Boeing not really taking an interest in how airlines work, right? It'd be like this weird thing of like, huh, how do you even perform that role then? I think it's a little bit different in the case of Facebook in that the user-facing experience, what we all see when we use Facebook, is kind of one thing. And then historically, and this is true everywhere, not just Facebook, you know, the ads team kind of comes along kind of in the back, kind of catching whatever comes off the product bus and trying to turn it into money somehow. And so it's this weird duality between, you know, the part that really matters, quote-unquote, of the company, and then the part that actually makes money. Which in tech, those two parts of the company are not actually the same, which is very unusual. But it's very typical in Silicon Valley.
Well, talk to me about that for a second, though. Is that how Facebook makes money? That is, those pop-up ads relative to things I've searched, and if I click through, then Facebook gets money from those companies? I mean, is that the model, and is that the mainstream of revenue?
Well, one of the interesting ironies of the story is that, I mean, that's very important. But at the end of the day, what, you know, ended up saving Facebook, because just to set the context, this book takes place from a year before to a year after the IPO, right when, you know, Facebook's earliest attempts on monetization were kind of plateauing in terms of growth. And so there was this sort of desperate push to come up with new ideas. And that's how I, you know, sort of randomly stumbled in to this situation where, you know, random ideas that before had been considered sort of heretical, like, what do you mean we're going to join Facebook to the outside world? We're taken seriously, right? And so there was a pretty big debate about how to do that. How much should Facebook control? How open should it be? There's a whole business discussion for those who like, you know, talking about how the internet gets paid for in the book. But, you know, the short of it is, what really saved Facebook is that right about the time that I left and just after, Facebook became mostly a mobile experience, which, I mean, now we almost take for granted 2 years later. But it was still the case when I was there that most Facebook usage was, you know, on the desktop, you know, in the first world on a machine you own, you know, in the developing world, in an internet cafe you'd gone to. But then suddenly out of nowhere, suddenly all the usage went mobile. And what Facebook did that was, and it's a credit to the company, that it pulled this massive pivot and just became a sort of mobile-first company. What's amazing about that is that, you know, there's a saying in the marketing world, money follows eyeballs, right, even if slowly. Right? And so it's always the case that wherever there's human attention, money will follow. But often there's a lag there, right, which is why there's so much money in TV still, but there isn't, say, on the internet, relatively speaking. But in the case of Facebook, they actually managed to make the money chase the eyeballs, like literally within a year of this transformation happening. And that ultimately is how Facebook really makes money. It's the newsfeed ad that you see on your mobile app. Some of them you don't even see are ads because they're so part of your experience. They don't actually pop up like the other annoying mobile ads. You know, they're just in between a post about your friend or your niece or your nephew or whatever, right? And there is an ad. And those ads, and I know everyone says, oh, I never click on ads, but that's actually not true. The click-through rate on those ads is actually remarkably high, for ads at least. And so that's really how Facebook makes money. It's the mobile ad in your feed.
Is there something pernicious about mining my searches and monetizing that, selling that? I mean, you're almost afraid what you reveal about yourself these days and to whom you don't know.
No, and I'll tell you why. It's understandable why you would sort of hesitate to share so much of your personal lives with this, what seems like this faceless corporation called Facebook. But, I go into this at length in the book. You know, the reality is that, and don't take this the wrong way, obviously, right? But all your personal information, like, you know, a message to your wife or your partner, personal photos, from the point of view of the advertiser, I mean, even assuming Facebook is perfectly evil, that has almost no value from a commercial point of view. An advertiser wouldn't pay to know that. I think the best way to put it is, you know, you might be embarrassed to have a nude photo of you on the internet. That doesn't mean anyone would actually pay to see it, right? And I think that's the difference that most people don't understand, that a lot of that personal data really has no commercial value, which is what we discovered in my first year at Facebook. I was charged with turning that personal data into money, and it was remarkably hard to do. It didn't improve ads targeting. It didn't improve ads performance. It didn't improve monetization at all. And so I think if you really want to be paranoid about something, I wouldn't really worry about Facebook, who at the end of the day wants to keep you as a user forever. I would worry more about the advertiser, you know, some company that you buy stuff from, and what they do with your data. Because at the end of the day, they just want to sell you, you know, another car or a sweater or whatever, and they really don't care how they do it. Well, at the end of the day, Facebook, believe it or not, does have your sort of longer-term interest at heart. And so Facebook, I think, really isn't the bad guy in this data story, to the extent there is one. It really is more the advertisers themselves.
Chaos Monkeys is Antonio Garcia Martinez's book. It's subtitled Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. It's about his story into and out of Facebook, Twitter, etc., and then his own company as well. By the way, while you were at Facebook, the like button was already there, right? And what did Zuckerberg or any of you think about the fact that if I said, hey, my grandpa died, and then you wanted to reach out and tell me, oh, I'm there for you, you would have to like that comment. Did anybody think that like was almost an inappropriate word for the way that thing was being used?
Well, I think, you know, inside Facebook, there's so much Facebook usage among Facebook employees. It was actually used to collaborate, and it was actually part of the way you did work. I think people there, you know, it was such a part of their life, they understood that there were subtleties and nuances in the use of that like button. But I think it was understood, and mind you, nobody talked about this on the ad side, of course, but it was understood that when you like something, you know, you're expressing a positive sentiment. And let's face it, all sentiments are not just positive, right? And so I don't know if you saw, but recently, within the past few months, they shipped reactions. And instead of having the like button, you kind of have like a fuming, angry face. You have like a happy face. And you have a series of different sort of more subtle reactions. And so they never quite shipped the unlike button, which is what everyone wanted because they just wanted to express negative emotion. But at the very least, they did ship a button that lets you express, a slightly wider range of emotions rather than just kind of implicitly assuming that like is, you know, whatever you want it to be. Yeah.
Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. It's the anecdotes are just so juicy and fun in this book. And your attitude is right there too, Antonio. It's a really fun read. And last question. So the movie, have you sold the rights? Who's going to play? Why do you laugh? I mean, this is a movie, man. Your life story there.
Yeah. That's an interesting question. It has come up. My agent tells me he's on it. Who would play me? Interesting. Everyone says I kind of resemble Javier Bardem from No Country for Old Men, if you remember that film. I think he's getting a little long in the tooth. There's a Venezuelan actor called Edgar Ramirez, that was he was in Zero Dark Thirty, actually, and he kind of resembles me a little bit. He's obviously, they're both better looking versions of me, obviously, but yeah, if I were to pick an actor, I guess it would be those two.
Good luck to you, Antonio. We'll visit again, but congratulations. It's a great story.
Great. Thank you, and thank you for reading.
The book is Chaos Monkeys. All right, so there is that. Speaking of movies, Big Lebowski, I want you to hear a couple of bites from that for reasons that you may understand in a minute, coming up on WGN. David Huddleston passed away this week at the age of 85. They say you may not know that name, but you'd sure recognize his face. And then they point out Big Lebowski. It's a movie a lot of people in my family love. I haven't seen the movie, if you can believe that. Our producer, Griffin, has. And so, Griff, you've got some audio for us.
It's really one of my favorite movies of all time. People might not remember. People think Jeff Bridges is the Big Lebowski, but David Huddleston was the Big Lebowski. He's right. The title character of that movie. They share the same name, Jeff Lebowski.
Okay.
David Huddleston, his version of Jeff Lebowski, his wife is kidnapped. And then the guys that kidnapped her try to get ransom out of Jeff Bridges. It's a classic mix-up. That's how they are brought together. So then there's so much to get through. I have no time. This is killing me.
No, but you don't have to explain the whole plot. But, like, what's this scene we're going to listen to?
So he has sent Jeff Bridges to drop off money for these kidnappers. And things did not go well. And Jeff Bridges has to explain that to him, or attempts to anyway. And then something very disturbing happens at the end. I think we'll go to it now.
Okay.
They did not receive the money, you nitwit! They did not receive the money! Her life was in your hands!
This is our concern, dude.
We dropped off the damn money.
We?
Why? The royal we. You know, the editorial, I dropped off the money exactly as per... Look, man, I've got certain information, all right? Certain things have come to light, and... She kidnapped herself. You know, a young trophy wife in the parlance of our times, you know. She, owes money all over town, including to known pornographers. And that's cool. That's cool. She needs money, man. And, you know, of course, they're going to say they didn't get it because she wants more. Hasn't that ever occurred to you, man? Sir?
No, Mr. Lebowski, it had not occurred to me.
That had not occurred to us, dude.
Since you have failed to achieve, even in the modest task which was your charge, since you have stolen my money, since you have unrepentantly betrayed my trust, I have no choice but to tell these bums to do whatever is necessary to recover their money from you, Jeffrey Lebowski. And with Brandt as my witness, I will tell you this. Any further harm visited upon Bunny will be visited tenfold upon your head. By God, sir, I will not abide another toe.
I will not abide another toe.
He's holding on to a toe that has been sent to him. And he reveals it to Jeff Bridges there. It's the best movie of all time. I love it so much.
Just play the next bite then. This is real short, but so who's in this next scene?
Now, John Goodman is the friend that Jeff Bridges brought along and was not supposed to. And he's saying that, don't worry about the toe, basically. Here's the clip.
That wasn't her toe, dude.
Whose toe was it, Walter?
Nothing about it indicates.
Yeah, the nail polish, Walter.
Fine, dude. As if it's impossible to get some nail polish applied to someone else's toe.
Someone else? Where are they going to get...
You want a toe? I can get you a toe. Believe me. There are ways, dude. You don't want to know about it, believe me.
Yeah, but Walter...
Hell, I can get you a toe by 3 o'clock this afternoon with nail polish.
And by the way, the voice that you... The third voice that you heard in the first clip we played was the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman as well. So.
Oh, wow.
Amazing.
David Huddleston passed away at 85 and gave us a chance to laugh again today. Okay, a little late for the news, but that happens sometimes. We'll do that next on WGN. Folks are going to come see our Teddy Roosevelt show next weekend. We'll be done 1 week from right now. In fact, it's a 10 a.m. show at the College of DuPage. I'll be on stage. I'll introduce Teddy Roosevelt. He'll come out. He and I talk for a while about his life and current events, and then you get to ask questions, too. We do a Thomas Jefferson version of this. We do a Teddy Roosevelt version of this. The shows are transformative. I'll just say that, because you really believe that that's him on stage. And when it's all a spontaneous, unrehearsed conversation, and to hear him talk about San Juan Hill or being a cowboy or busting trusts, it's just really a very positive, heartwarming, funny, but true experience. So to start the show, though, our own Bob Kessler is going to come out, right, Bob? This is the plan.
I will come out. This is, yes, this is the plan, as we talked about it an hour ago. I like the plan.
Okay, and you sample for us. Don't give us the whole song, because
sure,
we want to leave something on the table there, but tell me what you're going to, let's hear what you're going to play.
It's Sousa's harmonica wizard, Mart, so. I've been working on that ending because it's written as, but I've been doing double stops, just playing around with it.
Because
these
loving
marches
it.
Are so
oh,
ornamental.
Man. Yeah,
so
well,
kind of romantic.
Do whatever you want. I mean, I'm there for you, man.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, so you'll come out with that sort of musical introduction, mm-hmm. and then we'll take it from there. Okay, looking forward to hearing that. Thank you, Bob. Go to WGNradio.com, WGNradio.com/events to find out more about our show, 10 a.m. College of DuPage on Saturday.
Kristen Decker was just in here. She shot video of me practicing. I think it's on the Instagram.
Oh, no kidding.
It
cool.
is. It's on the new
oh,
feature,
Kristen.
The Instagram stories.
So how do I access that, Deck?
So if you go to Instagram, you'll see at the very top now, there's all these, whoever you follow on Instagram now have a story. So it's like 15-second video or a picture that disappears. It's with after you look at it after 24 hours. So it's kind of like competing with Snapchat.
Disappears. I want people to watch it.
They will, because they're going to watch it today.
That sounds great. Oh no, I'm really happy Bob's going to be on stage, and thanks for posting that too, Deck. Okay, so it's time for our Vibe Score segment. Griff, you normally start us off with a song. Okay, that's Britney Spears, and Vibe Score is an app. Vibe Score, one word, V-I-B-E-S-C-O-R-E. It's a free app you can put on your iPhone. We'll feed you the news and ask you a scorable question at the end. So if you're following the music group, each week we'll give you another song to rate. And this week, I guess we're rating Britney Spears, huh, Griffin?
Yep, that was my fault. That was the video. I forgot it was they cut back in with the laughter and clapping for dudes stripping for Britney, basically, was what that was.
Either way, you could tell it was Britney singing. I'll bet Bob Kessler's not going to like it this week. He's usually a Debbie Downer in this segment.
I just know what I do like, and yes.
And it's no John Sousa march on the
it's
harmonica
no
now, was it?
No, it's not.
I found it to be just as quaint and
wow.
Historical.
I found myself defending Britney Spears more as a cultural object in the last couple of years, but wow, that's terrible. That's a bad song. I'm going to give that about I'm going to give it about a 9, Griff. That's
Wow, that's really bad.
9.
Well, what's your vibe score for that, Deck?
45. Brit did not bring it this time.
Well, it just sounds so just, Britney Spears.
It does. It's not. There's nothing really catchy to make you. There's no like little saying. Like usually, there's a song that she has that goes, "I'm Britney, yeah." You know the B word. Like that was catchy. Everybody knew that song.
Later on, go cha, and then we'll go ahead and figure out what you just
meant. Yeah, but this one is just blah. And she sounds so auto-tuned, as she always does.
That's the thing. I'm like, what are you doing, girl? Come on, you're better than this.
Yeah, that's what everybody does now, though. I'm not crazy about it, but I don't. I'm surprised to hear the ire we've mustered for it.
I know.
What's
and
your
I'm
score,
a,
Griff?
And
I
this is a, like... I'm a Britney supporter too. I'm a champion of the Britney Spears experience.
I went like 60. I think it's fine. I don't know. You know, it's getting a 64.
She has. She does not have control of her finances. Did you know that?
Her dad does, right?
I don't think it's her dad anymore. I think it's a court-appointed administrator handles all of her financial stuff and a lot of the decisions about her life, so she doesn't just completely fall off the rails. And it's working for her. I mean, she's doing okay now, but it's a very weird sort of living arrangement that they've come up with for her.
That story about it, I can't remember where I read it. It was a long story about all about that. It was fascinating.
Well, yeah. I know a ton of girls around my age that love to go to Vegas to see her. She's like a hot ticket out there.
It's a big deal.
I know a ton of girls your age who could use a court-appointed administrator to handle their financial affairs.
That too.
Okay, what's next, Griff?
In the food and drink category, it's hot outside. Good time for a cold treat.
Did you write this?
I did. Because of the heat. Do you understand? I don't want people to lose me here. So it's hot, and you want to eat something cold to make you less hot. Okay.
Sure.
Just making sure that we're all on the same page.
I'm trying to.
That's a cool treat.
Bob, are you with me? Okay. So is a popsicle the best way to go? Are you a fan of popsicles?
Absolutely. 93. They are sweet, they are cool,
when's
and they don't have as many calories as
When's the last time you
cream.
Ordered a popsicle? When's the last time you bought a popsicle, Decker?
Actually, yesterday at Aldi, I have three boxes now in my freezer.
There you go.
Fair
enough. Makes me think of American Graffiti. Have a popsicle. Wolfman Jack, you know? Have a popsicle.
Where's everybody else at? Come on. Are you a fan?
Well, I'm tortured because I want to support the concept of popsicles, but I haven't had one in a very long time.
I could never have imagined how upset you would sound answering the popsicle question.
That's because I care. I don't just whimsically vibe score things, okay?
Popsicles are great. They should get a high score.
Okay, popsicles, 55, final answer.
Yeah, I hate to say it. I went around 58.
What?
They're overrated.
Because, no, I actually like them. It's been a long time, that's true, but I always think of when people bite into popsicles, it makes me want to die.
Oh, I bite my popsicles.
Or gnaw on the popsicle stick. I hate touching that with my teeth.
It's that visceral reaction of,
it's like
fingernails.
That crunch of the ice on your teeth, yeah.
I don't like that at all.
Well, I don't know if they're listening, but what are popsicles getting right now, Griff?
78.
78 for popsicles.
They're all American.
Let's do a sports one.
Am I with you?
You are with us.
Sorry
you
about
are
that. My thing got locked up. My lights were telling me different. Okay. In the sports category, what's your score for the opening ceremonies that were last night to the 2016 Summer Olympics?
I haven't vibed this one, so I'm going to push the number up. I'm going to go 90. 90.
Wow. I would go 58. Meh. With a comment of meh.
I am so critical of people that are critical of the opening of the Olympics. Decker, you just climbed down like three rungs on my ladder. We are less friends than we once were.
Why?
Because.
What's wrong with being critical?
Why
on the
are
Olympics?
You,
on the opening ceremonies, I mean.
Because you're being critical of these little people from all around the world. This is their one shining moment, and you're just like, I guess it wasn't good enough for America's entertainment values. Stop it. Let these people have the
but
moment.
But don't put it as a question on vibe score.
I think it was all downhill once he heard how much you love popsicles.
Yeah.
There's no recovering this relationship. Well, where are you, Griff?
Luckily, I didn't get to watch, and I don't have to be in the middle of this. I can abstain from
In general, what do you think of the opening ceremony? It's no athletic event. It's just pageantry. Vibe it.
I don't know. I don't know. I guess it's fun. It gets you
in
the
Kessler
spirit.
Is Kessler listening to WGN radio right now?
What do you think? I love the opening ceremonies, the stuff I saw. I loved especially, what was it, that model?
Giselle Bundchen.
Yeah, in her last catwalk, and they had Antonio Carlos Jobim's grandson play.
The girl from Ipanema.
Yeah, that was awesome.
So close your eyes, because that's a lovely way to be.
I'm sorry, I don't see how a model has anything to do with the Olympics.
She's
so
from
I'm not
Brazil.
Impressed.
Think about this.
But she's not an athlete, so therefore I don't care.
Right, and Jobim's a national hero there.
Yeah, so, that's the music of the whole culture. Listen, if they did Chicago and they did, there we all are, packed into the Olympic Stadium, or maybe it's Soldier Field, retrofitted for the Olympics, what would be the story that we would be telling the world about Chicago, right?
Jordan, Mike Ditka.
The Chicago Fire.
The Blackhawks, all of our great sports
teams.
They'd have Buddy Guy there.
No, that's not. It's not true, though.
I think they would have to tell
would
the
story.
They would tell the story of Chicago. They would tell the fire. They'd have Kanye West would be singing something. Yo, yo, he'd be doing some stuff out there.
We need to move on. This is not.
Okay.
It's getting a 63.
Okay, fine. What?
So it's getting a 63. I figured that would upset you.
So therefore, not a lot of people agree with me that it was meh.
All right, go ahead, Griff. What's next?
All right, well, how excited are you for the games? We also asked that. Just
100.
100.
83.
I'm with you guys. I'm very excited. I'm really looking forward to watching 55, and a lot of people scored.
Yeah.
It blew my mind. A lot of low scores. I was very surprised to see that.
I wonder if it's because of all the negative press around
Rio. I think
Rio.
You're on to something there, Decker. I think, let's hear these games out. I'll bet let's repost this one for next week and see if that doesn't improve.
I think that's a good point. Every time the lead up is always all negative.
Yeah.
And
right.
Then they start and it sort of fades away. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We'll see.
Okay.
In the movies category, that clip we just played from The Big Lebowski, actor David Huddleston died last week at the age of 85. He starred in many films, Blazing Saddles, The Producers, and, of course, The Big Lebowski as the title character. So we just put up the full version of that scene that we played a couple clips of, and unedited, obviously. It's a little more fun with the cursing in there,
mm-hmm.
and ask people to score it.
Oh, okay. Good. Yeah. Well, I'm not a, I don't know that movie that well. I sure thought that sounded like a fun scene. So I'm up there. I'll jump on and probably be vibing in the upper 80s.
Yeah,
How about you, Griff?
I think we need to remedy that situation, too. You got to sit down and watch it. It's one of my favorite movies, so I gave it a 95.
And I gave it an 82.
Fair enough. All right. What's it getting, Griff, right now?
Well, before we started, I think with it's up in the 90s. It's doing well.
Okay. All right. Give me one more.
In the viral category, that dude that did the free fall into a net from 25,000 feet, Luke Akins.
Akins, yeah.
We posted the video of that in the viral category, asked you what you think.
Yeah. I've come a 180 on this. I was a hater, and I thought it was bizarre and also really bad judgment that his 4-year-old son was there at the waiting, like on the ground waiting for him. Like, if he missed, you know, he sees his dad get turned into a tomato on the pavement. That's terrible. But he hit it, and it was just so much fun to watch. As stunts go, I think that's way up there. That's with the guy that, you know, put the balloons on his chair and floated up into the sky. I gave that a good score.
I missed that one.
I missed that one, too. Are you thinking of Balloon Boy?
No, well, you know, the guy in Los Angeles about 25 years ago, he put the weather balloons on his lawn chair and went up into the airspace above LAX.
Wow.
And pilots are flying around going,
We got a guy up here, and he's in the lawn chair.
He thought he was going to go up 200 feet. He went up 15,000 feet shot the balloons out with a BB gun. You guys don't know this story.
I'll have
sure
to YouTube
you
that.
I know that story,
And then he descended it back down, and then he thought he would be famous. He was kind of an upset guy. His girlfriend eventually broke up with him, and about 10 years later, unable to get his feet underneath him as he were, he committed suicide.
That's
it's this
awful,
tragic, amazing stunt story. Aren't you glad I brought it up?
Yeah.
That should be a movie.
Okay, that's
well,
just one of the
stunt I liked. I gave it an 87. I probably watched the him falling into the net 50 times.
That's
I just
the
kept
thing. I did find
redoing
myself
it
watching
over
that.
And
yeah.
over.
What a cool net! Yeah,
It's getting a 65. I think the scoring that we did was a little. It was like, this is so stupid, 0. Or it's amazing, 100. Really, you want to give it a 50. It seems like both stupid and amazing.
You're right about that.
Could you not do that? But then watching it, it's pretty incredible. I don't know.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. Do the last one, Griff, the TV episode TV show.
Sure, I'm not watching, but HBO's The Night Of is the best show of the summer for many. A lot of people think that. It tells the story of a kid in the wrong place at the wrong time. To say the least. And we asked, have you watched? What's your score for the show?
I haven't vibed on this one either, but I'm going to give it about a 90. It's one of those shows that's so good, it's almost hard to watch. It's tense. It's painful.
Yeah.
It's a good show. It's a good show. Have you seen this one, Deck?
I have not, so that's on my list.
The Night Of. The Night
HBO?
Of. HBO? Yeah.
All right. On it.
So that's our Vibe Score segment for this week. Thank you, Griff. Thank you, Deck. You can get the app Vibe Score, one word, free. We feed you stories on topics you're interested in. You get to score the news, and then we review it on Saturday, and Griff gets real frustrated at me. That's the little bit we do here on WGN. The boys from the beat are right around the corner. That's coming up next.